Grapple fans, and welcome to the third installment of March Mania, this special month-long celebration of matches taking place over the 40 years of WrestleMania, where myself, let me tell you something, co-host Lorcan Mullen, and the skip to my zip,
Mr. Simon Cross,
discuss matches over the wide history of WrestleMania, and when possible, we bring in a third voice as well to give a differing perspective and to make the pick of the match that we're covering. But this episode is a really exciting one, and an example of what's amazing about doing podcasts and just releasing your stuff out there into the internet, because you never know who's going to find it. Because we have on now a guy who's been in touch with us online several times over the years. He sent a few recommendations for Match of the Week, and we're so excited to finally have him on as a guest, because we've talked about doing this for so long. It is the rapper, producer, all-around artist and wrestling fan, Novelist. Novelist, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yo, thanks for having me. Super excited. Huge fan of the show, man.
So, for people that don't know, Novelist, you are a Detroit-based rapper, but you also do a podcast called Swordcast, where you discuss wrestling, but also other parts of pop culture that interest you, like anime. If you want to just give a little description of Swordcast and also maybe an idea of the sort of influences you have in your music as well, just so people who don't know you can check you out.
Yeah, I do have a podcast called The Swordcast with my best friend and my sound engineer. He's my main producer. His name's Hero, and we talk about a lot of stuff. We do we always discuss anime, we always discuss pro wrestling, we always discuss video games, we discuss films that we love. We do, both of us have martial arts backgrounds, we talk about martial arts a lot. So yeah, if you're into any of those things, you know, the Swordcast is the name of our podcast as well.
And to give just even more credence to Novelist's rep that you should have when you think about this guy, you did a song with another artist called Megaran called Clash of the Titans that is dedicated to the Kenny Omega Kazuchika Okada matches. And you even were able to get Kenny Omega himself to intro the track. How did that come into being? How did you get Kenny Omega to do that? And what's been the feedback you've had from that song?
Yeah, I have a lot of fans love that song. You know, long story short, that is my number one favorite wrestling match of all time. I absolutely love both Kenny Omega and Kazuchika Okada. Mega Ran is another fellow MC. He's been a big influence on me and also a great friend over the years. He's also a big wrestling fan, and he has a great presence in the wrestling industry as a rapper as well. And a lot of wrestlers know him, and he has been on Ring of Honor before, and he's got a good presence there. So, you know, when I came up with the song idea, I was, you know, had this idea of me playing the Okada role in the song and him playing the Kenny Omega role in the song. And, you know, a couple years prior, I actually went to Japan with him, and we went to Wrestle Kingdom 12. And wow, it was one of the best times of my life. And he has a relationship with Kenny, and we tried to link up. It just didn't work out. But, you know, he was able, when we made the song, he was able to reach out to Kenny and get Kenny to do the voice drop for the track, which is amazing. And then, you know, another really cool kind of thing that spins off of the song is, you know, last year at, well, I guess it's 2 years ago now at AW All Out, which was, you know, I guess we call it Brawl Out now, because that was the night that the fight happened. I was able to reach out to Kenny, and he answered back, and he got me two tickets to All Out. Amazing seats, and I was able to surprise my son, drove to Chicago, road trip, and we sat right at the ramp. It was amazing. My son, it just blew his mind. It was his first pay-per-view. He's a huge Jon Moxley fan, so that was really cool too.
Must make all the hours of hard work and dedication and everything that must go to this, like, worth it for those moments.
Absolutely. And Kenny, man, from what I met him before, I've interacted, he's just a solid human being, man.
I've just listened back to the song a couple of times in the last few days. I remember I put it in my playlist of my favorite songs for the year. I always do like a playlist, not like January to December, but like from my birthday. So I associate them each with the days of my years of my birthday. And that one was in there for that year, and I just was looking at it again. And on Spotify now, you can see, they do like montage of the match as well on the as you're playing it on Spotify, at least on your phone. And that's
cool.
But this couplet in particular was one that I really loved. High angle German suplex with the wrist control, separate your physical body from your invisible soul. That's just awesome, that line.
Thank you, man.
Do you plan to do... Well, I was saying, if you'd love to do it in the future, I think... I've always said there's an episode talking about, like, hip-hop's influence on wrestling and wrestling's influence on hip-hop, because the two mix and match so well and so often have... Maybe not in the days of Men on a Mission, but the days of, like, Swerve Strickland... Now it's starting to, and artists like yourself and Wale and Killer Mike and everyone else, and Post Malone doing stuff with like The Undertaker and everything.
Right.
They seem to fit so well if you get it right. And
yeah,
is it something you'd like to do more of? Because I was thinking, because there's talk of doing a Ric Flair biography, and I don't know if that's a good idea. Because the Iron Claw hides some stuff, you know. Yeah. But I always thought an amazing... there's a great Bob Dylan movie that's about Bob Dylan, but he's like different actors playing at different ages. And they're not playing Bob Dylan, they're sort of playing characters inspired by Bob Dylan. So like Richard Gere plays him, Heath Ledger plays him, Christian Bale plays him. And I always thought there'd be a great like hip-hop concept album of various rappers of different ages doing tracks about different stages in Ric Flair's career from his... his college, you know, his being adopted,
right.
His college days, him being trained by Vern Gagne, the plane crash, the four, like the Four Horsemen. You could do one of those come togethers, like the Forever song for LeBron James and everything, all the way through to the end, you know, and then you can kind of address some of the bad things in a weirdly more honest way. Do you know where I'm, do you get where I'm coming from with that?
Absolutely. I think that's actually kind of a brilliant idea. I think there's definitely a lot of similarities between hip hop and pro wrestling. I mean, even just as an indie fan, I've been to a ton of indie shows over the years. And when you go to an indie show, the scene is, it's very similar to my underground hip hop shows, you know, where these guys are interacting with fans and selling their merch at tables and stuff during the matches. And it's got a very similar vibe to like the underground music scene. And I think, you know, those two art forms really meet each other, and you have this world that is there. There's this mutual admiration between the two. For sure.
Yeah.
Would you say, because for me, novelists, the way I view it is it's beyond their in-ring work, or in the music case, the music itself. It's how that they connect with their audience beyond that. Is that where you find the similarity?
I think so, yes. And also just the whole... you're in this field where there's so many people doing what you're doing. How are you going to connect with your fans differently? And how are you going to separate yourself from the majority and stick out and make a name for yourself and, you know, conjure up a fan base that will follow you on your journey. As though, you know, it's very similar between wrestling and just being a music artist in general.
Was that a conscious decision on your part that a lot of your music does make those anime, wrestling, pop culture references? I guess Wu-Tang Clan obviously were the first ones to bring in like the martial arts. Well, maybe they're not the first ones, but like the first big names to bring in that element of it to their music. Is that one of your ways of trying to find your audience?
I do love Wu-Tang, but I think, you know, just being yourself and just letting yourself come out in your music and not trying to make it like other things that are, you know, that are popular or being heard. I think if you be yourself and you know, and we all have unique things about ourselves and interests that we like, but just let it come out in your art and not so much try to make your art something else. Yeah. And I think that just works.
Well, that's been brilliant. Like I said, we could talk about this for a whole episode, and maybe we will sometime in the future. But let's get to the match itself. This was your pick, Novelist. Simon, if you just want to introduce what match we're covering, and then Novelist will go to you and say why this match in particular is something you would love to talk about. So, Simon?
Yes.
Yeah, so we are looking at a match taking place at WrestleMania 12 for the WWF Championship. Well known in history, it is an 60-minute Iron Man match between the defending champion, Bret the Hitman Hart, and the challenger, Shawn Michaels. It takes place March the 31st, 1996, at the Arrowhead Pond of Anaheim, which is in Anaheim, California. It's an interesting one. Again, like late March, and an attendance of 18,853, which for a WrestleMania, like part of this project, it's the low attendance WrestleManias I still can't fully comprehend as a child of my generation.
Yeah. Because your first was WrestleMania 18, wasn't it? So apart from 20 to 22, every WrestleMania for you has been in the stadium show, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, but that's my era. Yeah.
This was the time when 18,000 is the equivalent of a stadium show for WWF as far as their ticket sales and everything were going. But yeah, Novelist, I remember listening to a Swordcast episode where you actually polled, I think, your listeners on their favourite wrestler. By quite a distance, Bret Hart came out first. I know he's a personal favourite of yours. But
Be honest, Lorcan, how many times did you vote?
Lorcan only voted once. Borkin, Dorkin, Corkin, Rorkin. They may have made some other votes. But yeah, sorry, Novelist. Feelings for this match and Bret and Shawn as well. And the WWF as well. Like, maybe give us an idea of, like, did you watch this back in 1996 when it first happened?
Yes. You know, 1996 this is really a special year for me when it comes to wrestling, because I was a young kid. I was maybe 8 or 9, but this is really a period where I have concrete, detailed memory of really getting into pro wrestling and being obsessed. And, you know, and these are the two guys who were at the forefront of WWF at the time, you know, and one of the reasons why I'm so high on this match is because, you know, as I got older, my taste evolved and kind of graduated way away from WWF and what they do. But this match, it really showed me the type of wrestling that I like, and it kind of formed my taste in wrestling, which is why I became such a big fan of Japanese wrestling and that style. I love Bret Hart, man. You know, when I was a kid, Bret's in my top five all time. Love him. Kind of, you know, similar to what you say all the time. He never makes you feel stupid for watching wrestling. You know what I mean? We all have those moments where you have a friend or something walk in when you're watching an anime or something, and they walk in at the weirdest part, and you're like, oh, you always watching that, man. Ugh. You know what I mean? And you're watching a Bret match, you're not going to have a potential embarrassing moment like that. But he's always been, you know, he's my brother's favorite wrestler, and he's just always been a big time pillar in my wrestling fandom growing up. I never liked Shawn, you know, when I was a kid. And, you know, part of it, you know, again, going back to, you know, what you always say is you're kind of, these two wrestlers are great examples of the style of wrestling that you gravitate towards, you know.
Yeah.
And I've always been into the technical wrestling, and Bret's kind of a no-nonsense, very realistic, you know, technical wrestler. And also, he just has a great look. And I always loved that he had the cool nickname, but it wasn't like his job. You know what I mean? IRS is Irwin R. Sharps, but he's like a literal, you know, he's like a literal
tax
person. You know what I mean? So it's like Bret had the hitman name, which was really dope, but he wasn't like coming to the ring with a sniper rifle and, you know what I mean? Like being an actual hitman. That was really dope too.
It's also one of those weird, like, those moments where you just think, oh my god, how did I not get this at the start? Like, it took me a good 20 years to figure out why his finish is called the sharpshooter.
Right.
And also that there was a pun in the excellence of execution. I just never, for some reason, got those things together. It's also funny to think that the original gimmick Vince offered him before he even was in the Hart Foundation was Cowboy Bret Hart. And where we could have ended up if that had happened. He's like, I don't want it. I just love Bret's so dry. And just in that documentary, whatever it was where he was saying it, he just says, I thought about it and I thought, I don't want to be a cowboy. I don't want to ride a horse. I'm scared of horses.
Which is a little weird because he comes from like the cowboy region of Canada. Obviously, Calgary does have its Stampede.
Yeah. I think that was why they thought it might work for him. Like when they do the Calgary Stampede show in 97, like they're all wearing cowboy hats on commentary and announcing, which is so weird to me because I just, growing up on Westerns, even though the title Western would suggest otherwise, I always thought of it as a Southern States thing, really. Did it surprise you, Novelist, I guess, when you get more into wrestling and I would assume at 8 years old or whatever, you're not aware of the discourse. Did it surprise you in later years when you found out that this is maybe one of the most divisive matches out there in like the smarky match rating world? Like, I looked it up on Cage Match and there are multiple reviews and ratings of the match that cover the whole gamut from 1 out of 10 to 10 out of 10. Did that surprise you?
Absolutely. And I would also say more so maybe than any other match that I enjoyed as a kid growing up and, you know, kind of looking back on it and seeing what people think about it now and how it aged. This is definitely the match that surprised me the most. You know, that it's so divisive and it's a, there's a huge scale, you know what I mean? Like you said, on Cage Match, like there's people that give it a 1, there's people that give it a 10.
Yeah.
But you know, this match was always, it just, it was so big to me as a kid, because as I said, this was when I was really tuning into wrestling. And I mean, you know, watching it every Monday, and she, you know, my mom would come in my room and she would make sure I was asleep, and then when she left, I would turn it back on and just turn the volume down. Like, this was at that time, you know, so everything they did, this match just, it felt like a huge deal, you know, and this was the first time I was able to order WrestleMania, you know, and part of it, you know, my mom would only let us get about two or three pay-per-views a year, you know, because they were so expensive. And this was the first time that I was just begging for WrestleMania, and it was because of this match. And, you know, the way they were kind of doing the vignettes, I don't know if you guys remember, they were like working out, and Sean was doing the crazy put, and it just felt like, it felt like a sporting, you know, a sporting contest. And again, that's, this is where my taste in wrestling was really started to get geared towards. I like it when it's presented as a contest of sport, and I like technical wrestling, you know what I mean? And all that started with this match.
Yeah, you're right. Like, most WWF matches wouldn't have an intro package like that or a build-up. But if you look at those New Japan ones, obviously most time they're not subtitled to be, so you don't understand them. They very often are structured, you're right, exactly like that. Both guys pondering existence seemingly whilst doing some rudimentary training in their gym or running out there and so on. That's a really, really good point, and why this would then, because it so sticks out as a match. Like, even amongst all the WrestleMania main events, there's no one like it. There's very rarely one, you know, there's very few WrestleMania main events will have gone more than 30 minutes, let alone 60. And I would assume there never will be another one that goes that long again. Not if it's a one-on-one singles match, unless they
never say never in wrestling.
I remember the four-way elimination at WrestleMania 2000 might have gone like 40 minutes, maybe. And some of the Triple H ones felt like 60 minutes.
But his first Undertaker one, definitely. Christ.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So, Simon, I mean, again, like, so much of this wrestling sort of pre-Attitude era, you just have never gone back on. Is that the same with this match, this era of wrestling? I mean, we've covered some Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels stuff from around this time, so maybe you've gone back to it a bit more, or maybe with the Bret Hart DVD or the Shawn Michaels DVD, because I know this was on at least one of those.
Yeah, I mean, Bret's a bit of a blind spot for me, and I'm sort of like, get my knowledge vicariously, well, basically through you, in a sense, really, Lorcan. I just had a light bulb moment as you guys were talking about it, and I'm just remembering now the MJF versus Bryan Danielson Iron Man match and the Sasha versus Bayley's, and they had the exact same, the vignettes of them working out in the advance. So I'm just wondering if this like set the template for how American promotions present Iron Man matches. This is really like the template one. This is the one everyone refers to. This is the first one, the innovator. I've always known it in that position, but you might have a go at me here, Novelist. I hadn't actually watched this match before. This is my first time experiencing this.
Yeah, that's super interesting as well. And you know, going off of what you just said, so my experience, I've talked to some pro wrestlers, and I've known a couple guys that have been into wrestling. I train, I do jujitsu, and a couple guys that that I train with that are big wrestling fans as well. And it seems like this match is really high amongst people who are wrestlers themselves. You know what I mean? I think this match is appreciated in the actual community of pro wrestlers, and they do view it as this piece of like study material. You know what I mean?
That was something I really thought. Like, there's so much thought put into this that you could break it down and study it. Like, I remember Roger Ebert would do like these 8 hour long events at colleges where they go through literally every frame of something like Citizen Kane or Casablanca. And they wouldn't like talk about every frame, but like when there was a point where anyone wanted to stop and talk about something, they would do that. That's a really good point. Again, I could see like an 8 hour masterclass going on with someone in like the role that Stevie Richards is now doing on YouTube. I remember Raven used to apparently do this backstage at ECW, that he'd take these tapes and just tell people why this works, why this is good. Yeah, and also just going back to that, like, wrestlers love it. I mean, it's Kurt Angle's favorite match,
Right.
which is another example, someone who literally comes from a sporting background. And so he appreciates it even, maybe even more than we do, because he'll see things that we don't see. Because it's interesting, you've said that, I think, in the past, that the Iron Man match is your favorite gimmick match. Am I right in remembering that?
Yes, it is my favorite gimmick match for sure.
Where do you stand on the debate between me and Simon, where I say I don't think a 30-minute match can count as an Iron Man match, really, as I consider it, because there are plenty of matches that go 30 minutes, but
Right.
not many that go 60.
No, I think it's got to be 60. And again, this is I think, and you could say that this is where that could come from, or you could also go back and look at Steamboat and Flair, who would go 60 minutes, and that could be the start of where that kind of became the time stamp of really showing that level of endurance and athleticism at 60 minutes.
The
So,
worst Iron Man match I can think of that I've seen in its entirety was a 30-minute one, and it was that horrible one that Dolph Ziggler and Seth Rollins had to main event a pay-per-view, and they just tried to cram so much in. Like, they tried to
right.
do a 60
Oh,
minute
yeah.
match in 30
In
minutes.
30 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it was sort of telegraphed what was going to happen, because Dolph built up like an incredible lead, and oh, Seth's got something to overcome.
I must admit, novelist, when I'm, it's one of the few areas where I think we would disagree, not severely, but like I've always found an Iron Man match kind of limited. It feels like I know what, you know how it's going to be structured insofar as it will. Not necessarily that it's like someone's got a big gap and they've got to build it up, but it's always going to, there's never going to be an Iron Man match where in the last 5 minutes it's like 8-2. It's
Right.
always going to be like 5-4.
No, it's got to be close, you know what I mean? There's some examples where I don't know if you've ever seen Ricky Steamboat versus Rick Rude from Beach Blast, I think too. That's another one of my favorite Iron Man matches.
That's definitely
And
my favorite 30-minute Iron Man match, that one.
yeah, and the way that one was kind of structured was really cool, and just that whole concept of like the guy willing to take the DQ to get the other falls. You know what I mean? We saw MJF do that too in the match last year, so.
What was interesting reading up in the past about the history of the Iron Man match, it seems like it might have been a Pat Patterson creation, like the Royal Rumble. And it was around the 80s he started doing it. And it's really interesting that the first match that was booked like that, a 60-minute marathon match, I think it was called back then, was the Rockers against the Rougeau Brothers, which is a really interesting one to start it off with. And then I was looking at the circuit that they were doing those matches on, and very often the main event would be like the Ultimate Warrior beating Andre the Giant in 30 seconds. So I wondered if that was like, we've got to give them their money's worth somewhere else in this. But it's interesting that obviously Shawn Michaels has that experience within that gimmick. And then Bret, when he was doing his runs with the WWF Championship, on the house shows, he would do a couple of Iron Man matches against Ric Flair and Owen Hart. I know there's a fan cam of both Bret Hart Flair Iron Man match and the Bret Hart Owen Hart Iron Man match. match. So they both have experience going into this, but this is the first time that the WWF has actually built a whole pay-per-view main event around a gimmick that maybe they invented, because, you know, up until the mid-80s, 60-minute matches were relatively regular if you're like the NWA World Champion.
Right.
Like Flair's the 60-minute man. And that's another reason why I think this match sticks out so much. It's like pre-mid-80s territories, or like post-2005 indie scene, 60-minute matches were either regular or semi-regular. Right. But like this one block here that this match is right in the middle of, it's so rare to have. There's a few 60-minute time limit draws in All Japan, I suppose, around this time. I think it's really interesting because some people said, like, oh, the crowd were bored. I never felt that the crowd was bored. The crowd were engrossed, but not like, it wasn't anything that they got before. You know, like the previous matches that we've covered for this is like the 12-minute Hulk Hogan Andre the Giant match and the 20-minute bold epic of the Ultimate Warrior against Randy Savage. But this one, it's so unlike any kind of WWF match, really.
That's the interesting thing, is it really is, when you think about this time, 1996, this, and then on this stage, right, you're doing 60-minute Iron Man technical wrestling match at WrestleMania, right? This is home of the commercial wrestling fans, right, mm-hmm. that aren't completely familiar with this type of thing, and is it going to be able to keep their attention? And then you're doing it as the main event, and this is in that kind of weird time where WWF is transitioning from like big steroid guys mm-hmm. down to more technical skilled smaller wrestlers like Bret and Shawn too. So there's all these different variables that make this match super interesting to me as an adult, even though I loved it as a kid, but still, you know, makes this one of my favorite matches.
Yeah, I was wondering, why would the WWF book this in 96? It seems so anti, like, what Vince thinks wrestling should right. be, usually. And I was thinking maybe two big reasons that I could think of. One was that the WWF's roster at this point was just relatively weak, 95 to 96. Like, if you look, I always say you can gauge the WWF's health usually by who they've got in their Royal Rumbles. Like, the 95 Royal Rumble is just Shawn, Davey Boy, a couple of other upper mid-carders, and then just a mess of, like, Heavenly Bodies and Blue Brothers. And
the Godwins.
Yeah, just Henry Godwin at this point. But they got, like, Dick Murdoch out for the 95 Royal Rumble. And 96, they're bringing in, like, one guy from USWA, they bring in Takeo Omori from All Japan to fill in a gap. And WrestleMania, I think, by far has the smallest roster of talent. Yeah. I think I was looking at it, like, in-ring, there's 22 wrestlers on the whole show. You know, they've had WrestleMania matches with Battle Royals with more people in that than this one. And so I was thinking that was not one reason. It's like, how do we fill 3 hours?
They could never do this now because the roster's loaded.
Yeah.
And they sort of cheated for one of the other ones because they used OJ footage because Roddy Piper Goldust is on this.
yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later in the episode. But the other reason I just realized is that one of the other matches, it's not actually on at the event, but it was the final blow-off match of the Billionaire Ted sketches of the Huckster and the Nacho Man, and saying that WCW, it's like the first time they really ever acknowledged their competition, and just saying these guys are old, they're broken down, and they can't do it anymore. Well, how do you show them up in their age more by having your two top guys be so athletically gifted and able to do it in the ring that they can go for 60 minutes when they're showing in like the pre-pay-per-view in their sketches, these guys are coming out on Zimmer frames and they all die of heart attacks in the ring, I think, at the end of it. So those are the two things I can think of as why Vince would make this risk. And I was also amazed that, like, I always assumed kind of after that he'd never do it again. And I was so shocked when Triple H and The Rock had their Iron Man match at Judgment Day in 2000. And then even more shocked that it was good. Because I just figured 6'4", 200, they're never going to have the cardio to do it. But this was like Triple H's miracle year of 2000, and The Rock was also, I think weirdly The Rock sometimes is underrated as an in-ring wrestler. Rock is anyway. But yeah, and then since then there was Brock Lesnar versus Kurt Angle, which I think a lot of people argue is the best Iron Man match of the WWE. And yeah, I don't think they've gone 60 since then that I can think of.
Not 60. They've done 30s. Obviously, the most modern recent example, which was good in my book, Sasha Bailey, that was a 31. Angle and Shawn had a 31 on Raw.
Yeah.
Those are the two other, like, big noticeable ones they've done since then.
Mm. But yeah, let's just get back to this match. How long had it been, Novelist, since you'd last watched this match? Was there anything, what was your experience, what was different watching it this, or was it something that, like, when you were a kid, it was on a loop, so you just kind of know this match blow for blow, like I know, you know, Bret Hart versus Davey Boy at SummerSlam 92?
So this match is a match that I used to watch all the time when I was a kid, and then I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it in a long time, you know, until I watched it recently for this. But watching it now as an adult and you know, I do plan on going back and reviewing it on Cage Match as well. But just watching it as an adult now, I just recognize so many details that I would have never picked up on a kid. Just, you know, just being a smart wrestling fan now, right, and understanding the business and understanding how all these things work. It was cool to go back and watch something and just see it from a smarter perspective.
Can you give an example of, like, a particular move or spot or the pacing or what you might have noticed this time?
One thing that I thought was brilliant in this match is the timekeeper spot, right, where Sean goes to super kick Brett and Brett moves out of the way and he just destroys the timekeeper with a super kick, right? But it was kind of like, so this spot happens where this first 15 minutes of this match is kind of a lot of chain wrestling and you know, and honestly, Sean's kind of doing some good submissions, but it's like he's not a submission wrestler, so the fans, they don't get excited because, you know, his finishing moves are not a submission, so they kind of don't really appreciate it. And then it's like this match has kind of been slow up until this point. And then you do this spot where Sean super kicks the timekeeper and it kind of like restarts the match and recharges it. And then they do this thing where not only do they do that, but then they do this whole thing where they got to stretcher this guy out and they're bringing the stretcher out. And then while they're doing this, Brett kind of rolls Sean back in the ring and just kind of slaps on a rest holdy chin lock, right? But it's like so brilliant to me because they're doing this and nobody's paying them any attention because everybody's paying attention to the timekeeper situation. So now you do this spot and you're getting yourself like 4 minutes of rest with no one looking at you. And I just think it's great, right? Like sometimes you watch, and I love all wrestling, right? I love AEW, but sometimes it drives me nuts when they go to the little picture-in-picture and then somebody does like a crazy move, but it's like nobody sees it because it's you're in picture and picture right now, you know what I mean? And it's this is a good example to me of, you know, these guys are buying themselves time and getting some rest while nobody's looking at them, you know what I mean?
And also it has the benefit of putting over the Sweet Chin Music as a killer move because
for sure
that guy was like, not moving
because it killed him, right?
It's crazy, that was one of the notes I made at the end, like the Sweet Chin Music he gives to Tony Chimmel looks so much more deadly than the two he actually does in the match. It's like the first one in particular, but I think they work that well because it's like this idea of exhaustion and maybe Sean didn't get all of it. And that Brett actually does get up before Sean does. I watched an interview that Brett did with Sam, and he said like those were conscious spots that they did that explicitly to give themselves like an interesting way to get 2 minutes into it. And they did that a couple of times, and I think it was also that sense of like this was a proper hard fight, and people were getting hurt just being in its vicinity. Like the ref takes a bump, and it's not to like set up any kind of cheating spot or anything. It's just like to say like these guys are going so hard that other people are getting damaged in the way. The only other time they've done that I can think of is like I remember Tim White taking some really nasty bumps in one of the Hell in the Cell matches that like ended up retiring him, and like the ref bladed to show like how deadly the Hell in the Cell was, that even reffing in it can make you bleed. And another time Paul Heyman bladed from just being on the outside and getting a cage kick to the face from the Undertaker,
right?
But
that one's horrid, that bloodbath one.
So Simon, what were your thoughts? Did you know about how divisive this match is, and what were your kind of initial thoughts going into? Were you prepping yourself for the 60 minutes? Did you know how it was going to go or anything?
I mean, one of the first times I saw this, like talked about at length, was it's like a WrestleMania Moments DVD where they had Ric Flair present. One of the interesting things is when they get to this, it's quite late in the DVD that they talk about this match. It's quite high up on the list. And he's holding a stopwatch in his hand as he's doing the bit to camera. And he explicitly says, if this match started at the start of you guys watching, it would still be going on. So that they've always revered it in how they presented it in WWE. And I was aware of the divisive discourse. And you do worry with any match that's an hour long of, do people have the talent to fill it? I mean, you shouldn't really worry when the two people in the ring are Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart. But I've talked about it in other episodes in things that we've covered, is that not all wrestling ages well. So I did go in with a little apprehension, but I do think they structured it well, as like Novelist alluded to. There's clear segments to the match. There's always a struggle, and the crowd are always with them. They're not always loud and like manic, a la Hogan and Andre, but they are always hooked on what they're seeing in the ring. You've mentioned that you practice jiu-jitsu, Novelist. Now, obviously, the first part of the match, there is a lot of mat-based wrestling. Now you're into jiu-jitsu. Did you appreciate that segment differently than maybe you would have when you were a child?
So me being into jiu-jitsu kind of ruins my my perspective on submissions and how guys are locking the submissions in, you know what I mean? So some of that stuff, Bob, but Sean did actually have a really clean armbar in this match, but then there was a time where there was a moment where he's working over Brett's shoulder, and then he applies the armbar to the wrong arm.
Yeah.
And then and I think Brett might have said something to him, because there's a moment in between, and then Sean actually applies it to the right arm. So, but yeah, that's interesting. So now when I watch guys like Bryan Danielson, I love Bryan Danielson. He's another wrestler that's one of my favorites, but I can tell that he has trained jiu-jitsu before, because of the way that he locks his submissions. You know what I mean? So it's, you see things like that. Zack Sabre Jr. too. I wonder if he trains, because his submissions are really clean as well. So
any opinions on The Undertaker's Hell's Gate?
So Undertaker's Hell's Gate is good too, right? But sometimes you'll hear them say that it's you hear them call it a go-go plata, and you hear him say it's a triangle. It's not a triangle, it's more so a go-go plata, and sometimes they call it the wrong type of submission. But no, Hell's Gate is legit. That's a legit good submission.
Let's just go into a little bit more about this jiu-jitsu training. Like, is it, they have belts, I assume, like other martial arts?
Yeah.
What level are you at?
There are belts. So I am a blue belt right now. So it goes white, blue, purple, brown, black. It takes about, if you're good at jiu-jitsu, it takes about 10 years to get a black belt. I've done other martial arts, but I started training jiu-jitsu about 2.5 years ago, almost 3 years. I've competed. I got some medals.
How are jiu-jitsu tournaments structured? Are they like a round robin, or are they knockouts? Because
normally, the ones that I've done, they have been round robin tournaments. It really depends on how many people are in your bracket. They do it by weight, and they do it by belt rank, and they do it by age, and they, you know, there's a lot of different variables that go into it. I've also done a quintet tournament before. That's where they have like teams, and so I've done one of those where different schools will kind of have an event where you're having teams of five go against each other. So it's a lot of different formats.
Not at the same time, like those Russian MMA events. So
a quintet is structured in a way where, so the two teams of five will go against each other. There will be one guy from this team, one guy from this team, the fight is 5 minutes. And if you submit the guy, he's out for their team, and their next guy comes in, and then the guy won. You stay in until you lose or get a draw. If nobody wins the fight in 5 minutes, both guys are eliminated.
Okay, so that's a bit like Survivor Series in a way, but that's really cool. I do think jiu-jitsu is a fascinating thing. How do you actually, because this is another point of contention in the podcast, what do you think of shoot style wrestling? Have you ever gone back and watched any of the old sort of UWF, UWFI? Do you think Pancrase was shoot or worked? Do you have any feelings on that?
So I don't like it, because I think the two, I think there's a fine big line between, you get a guy like Bryan Danielson, right? Clearly knows what he's doing in that regard, but it's still got pro, it's still progressing. know what I mean? The character and the other aspects of what he's doing still has pro wrestling elements in it. Same with Malakai Black, right? He's very good Dutch kickboxer, and he has that stuff in his offense. Clearly legit martial arts knowledge and training, but still makes it pro wrestling, right? I don't like watching something. I don't like watching wrestling try to be MMA without trying to be wrestling. You know what I mean? If I'm gonna do that, I would just watch MMA. You know what I'm saying? So.
Oh, I'm so on your wavelength with this.
I think I am for the most part. I think it's interesting to look at it, especially like the 80s, 90s stuff before we knew what, before MMA told us what a real fight looked like. So I find that part of it interesting. But I do get your point that like now, you couldn't, there'd be no point in doing a shoot style promotion. Maybe like a one-off match, you know, those blood sport events. Have you ever watched any of those? The Josh
Yes,
Barnett blood
I
sports?
actually love Josh Barnett's Bloodsport. I do. That's one of my guilty pleasure WrestleMania weekend shows that I love. But I also, you know, and then sometimes you hear stuff about Antonio Inoki kind of forcing guys to go do shoot fighting
Oh
and get
man.
beat up. So it's like,
Yeah.
you know what I mean? That's tough.
When I first told Simon the stories of what he did to Yuji Nagata, and
Oh, my poor boy.
started him off with Crow Cop, and that didn't work. All right, well, let's go with this Fedor bloke. Let's see how he does with him.
It's so crazy.
But yeah, I do want to get to that. It was funny watching it. I think at most I've watched this match maybe two times in its entirety before, and they might have been when like the Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart DVDs came out, because it was just hard for me to get my hands on wrestling outside of like the one tape I would get every year, and I guess I just wasn't that keen to watch Bret lose again. I suppose that was another reason. Even though my two favorite Bret matches are Owen at WrestleMania 10 and David Boy at SummerSlam, but that's in house, that's in family. I don't want to see Shawn getting one up on Bret, especially because I as a Bret fan, I was like, yeah, that is bullshit. Bret's right. That why did they didn't tell him it was going to be 62 minute match. Which is funny as well,
Right.
seeing them booking how they booked that, and we'll get into that in a bit. But watching it this time, like you, I really appreciated the effort Shawn made with the mat wrestling, and I assume that was to tell the story of like, because I think Bret in the package says, well, he's just like a Mexican jumping bean, and I don't respect that, so I'm just gonna out wrestle him. And so the
Right.
first 10-15 minutes are Shawn going like he has spent so much time prepping exactly for this, and he's gonna surprise Bret. And the story of the first 15 minutes is Bret getting frustrated at Shawn getting him one upping him in his discipline, and like obviously it not being what he expected Shawn to be presenting him with. But then finally, just a couple of times, Shawn makes mistakes. But for the first 30 to 40 minutes, I was kind of wondering. I first thought Bret was resting subtle heel, but then when Shawn was targeting his shoulder like so viciously, it was like, well, is Shawn being the subtle heel here?
Right.
Because, and so they were both doing it. And I think that's also sometimes the problem with babyface versus babyface matches, is very often, in order for them to have a bit of edge going into it, they have to kind of both make them assholes. I remember that being like in the build up to the Daniel Bryan Roman Reigns match. They just made them both kind of more
Yeah.
unlikable. As weird as
I
that
think,
sounds.
and I think it just becomes this thing where you're trying to show, you know, these guys want to win so bad that they're willing to, you know, become something different just so they can win the match. And even if that means, and you know, you'll see Tanahashi do that sometimes too. You know, he would do that in the Okada matches. He would start, you know, resorting to some heely tactics, and the crowd would boo him too, you know what I mean, when he would do that stuff. But again, it's just showing, you know, this guy wants to beat this other guy so bad that he doesn't care.
Well, that was what was so brilliant about Bret, that it was always a key thing of Bret was always thinking of how can I win the match? And if I win it by catching you in a cradle, that's
Right.
fine by me. And I'll happily win a title with a cradle. Like, it's funny when you look back at all his pay-per-view matches, how few of them he ever won with a sharpshooter. Like, most of the time it's through some sort of creative. He beat Diesel with a small package, he beat Yokozuna because Yokozuna fell over. But yeah, like every match that he won in the King of the Ring in '93, he didn't win with the sharpshooter in any of them.
So not the SummerSlam Davey Boy match, but one of my favorite matches is the, I think it was an In Your House he had with Davey Boy, where he was bleeding a lot. And he has a really dope, I want to say he does like a Lamaja Straw Cradle or something. Something like that in that match.
Which surprised me because Bret does seem to like. oftentimes, you know, he clearly somewhat doubted El Dandy. And at times it does seem like Brett's a bit anti-Lucha, and he seems to have some nasty words to say to Jose Lothario at one point in this match as well. But obviously, like you say, he will bust out something like that. So he must, maybe it's just part of the character that he's playing. And Brett was always so great as the subtle heel. For a babyface top guy, he wrestled quite a lot of face versus face matches in the WWF, I suppose. Like Davey Boy in SummerSlam, Roddy Piper at WrestleMania 8, Shawn Michaels in this, Diesel at the 95 Royal Rumble and Survivor Series.
Undertaker too, when they were both kind of babyfaces too.
Yeah, 96 Royal Rumble, and usually in those matches he would be the subtle heel. I guess because you always say with babyfaces, when they turn babyface, their IQ seems to drop like 20 points.
Right. I guess
because Brett's a babyface who wrestles with a high IQ like Tanahashi does, it works for him to be the one that, not even underhanded, but just the tricks. Like, he never cheats once against Davey Boy or Sean. Right. But he's that extra bit vicious in these matches. Like, the clotheslines that he hits in this match, or the European uppercuts, and Sean in return with, like, some of his, like, knees to the guts and everything. I mean, Brett has recently said, like, he hates how much all these wrestlers now rely on chops and kicks and just actually hurting each other. Whereas the secret is to make it look like you hurt each other and don't. And both these guys look like they're really hitting it, but whilst Brett did take a break off of it, it wasn't like he was injured. And obviously Brett and Sean are both known for being two of the safest in-ring workers, but this felt so hard fought. This felt as hard fought as like a Sheamus-Gunther match, but not with both of them coming out with like massive bruises on their chest afterwards. I mean, I'm not against that style of wrestling, but I get where Brett's coming from when he says, you know, I think Jim Cornette or Terry said, like, when people thought it was real, we weren't hurting each other. Now everyone knows it's fake and they're trying to hurt each other to get people in.
Right.
Do you appreciate that? Like, watching this, especially, like I say, you compare this to, like, no matches are wrestled exactly like this nowadays, except for maybe some of the Bryan Danielson MJF match. But again, that had babyface heel dynamics, so they didn't have to worry about that.
All I'll say is quickly, it does seem to be a case now where the chest bleeding from chops seems to be like some weird, like, in-house badge of honor. Mm-hmm. Like, you sort of have to have that to, like, truly be appreciated as, like, suffering for your art. It just seems a bit needless, because to quote that line from The Incredibles, once everyone's super, no one will be. If you're all doing it, it doesn't stand out. Mm-hmm. You know?
Right. Yeah, I feel that for sure. There's definitely an art to watching wrestling from, you know, a match with this level of technical ability where they're not, like you said, they're not killing each other. My favorite wrestler of all time is Keiji Muto, Great Muto, right? And he's a guy who, well, he would look like he was killing people, but if you listen to some interviews of some wrestlers, like, they all say that he had a really soft touch, and you would wrestle a match with him and, you know, you wouldn't feel anything. And I think there's definitely art to that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because I love Keiji Muto as well. And I was just actually thinking, you know, we've been saying, and you've alluded to it, that we say you're either a Brett guy or a Sean guy.
Yeah.
Like, if you're a Brett guy, you like FTR over the Young Bucks.
That one's true. That one's accurate.
Like, maybe back in the 80s, it wasn't you're a Brett or a Sean guy. It was you're a Bockwinkle or a Ric Flair guy. But the I was just thinking, if you're a Brett guy, you're a Keiji Muto guy. If you're a Shawn Michaels guy, you're a Great Muto guy. I was just thinking that, because
which is insane that this guy was, you know, both people.
Yeah, we did remember, I think it was your recommendation, actually, one of the match of the weeks we did off of your recommendation was the Muto Tenryu match. Do you remember that, Simon?
Yes,
that was brilliant.
I love that match. If
I do my top 40 matches this year, that is definitely going to be right up there in contention. I just, that whole Keiji Muto run in 2001, we've talked about doing,
it's like, my favorite run by any wrestler ever. I love seeing an old, and he wasn't even that old, he was 40 maybe, you know, but just seeing a wrestler who everybody thought was just washed, just completely reinvent himself and just come back, completely different style, different look, new finishing move. How many times do we see people successfully do that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
and just change everything about himself, you
Yeah,
know,
of all
because
the
he was in New Japan, he's bald, he's losing his hair, he had a big bald spot, and he was still trying to do the moonsault, and he just was slow, and then he just took that time off and came back and was a completely different person.
Actually, I was just going to say, because you were saying 2001's a great year, because I was thinking this, because I think one of the reasons that this is a divisive match is that, because, like, the philosophy of wrestling is kind of divided between Bret and Shawn guys, maybe. And if you would think the WrestleMania main event crowning of Shawn Michaels, which was what this was meant to be,
Right.
it wasn't a Shawn match. This is Shawn working a Bret match. But because it's a 60-minute Ironman match, and I don't know what a Shawn Michaels version of a 60-minute Ironman match sort of looks like, maybe weirdly the pace that Okada Omega went with their 60-minute match suggests that maybe you could do it at that pace. But
Right.
again, in 96, probably Shawn wouldn't even know how to
I
put
was
that
gonna say,
together
and who
necessarily.
else could do that? You know what I mean?
And Shawn had such an amazing year in 1996, but those other matches were the showy, offy, mostly high spot, you know, his Diesel match, Good Friends, Better Enemies. His match with David Boy, Beware of Dog, isn't that highly thought of, but I think his King of the Ring match is very underrated. That's one of my favourite Davey Boy performances. That whole 95-96 Davey Boy run is a bit underrated as well, when he kind of slimmed down and actually became like a combination of the power guy, but that super worker from the Stampede early WWF days as well.
Yeah, he has a really good man. I don't know what year, but he had that European title match with Owen on Raw. That match is amazing.
That was either late 96 or early 97.
Yeah, that's a really good match too.
His matches with Vader, I don't think any of them were considered classics, but they were good. His match with Mankind,
We've
Mind
covered one of
Games.
those. We did Mind Games, didn't we?
I think we did. That was that a five star, or did we do that as like an alternative?
You
We
guys
did it as
did
an
it as you
alternate.
did it as an alternative five. I remember that episode,
Which was for so long Mick Foley's favorite match, and then it wasn't a classic, but his match with Psycho Sid at Survivor Series is probably the best match Psycho Sid's ever had, and Brett didn't have as good a match with Psycho Sid, so that's one of the
yeah.
one up Shawn has. And so maybe the people that don't like this match are the Shawn guys that want something different from their boyhood dream coming true moment. Like, they're probably there. The thing about this that they love is Shawn Michaels coming down from the rafters. Like, that's the moment they associate with this more than anything in the match itself. Do you think that might be where those ones and twos might be coming from, the Shawn guys?
I do lean more Shawn than Brett, but I actually want to expand upon your point, Lorcan, about how divisive wrestling was at that time. So I've just looked up what WCW were offering on pay-per-view around this time, and it came out a week before.
Oh God, no! I know what you're talking about.
Uncensored 1996. You know where I'm going with this. And their main event is Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage defeating Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, Meng, The Barbarian, Lex Luger, The Taskmaster, Zed Gangster, and sorry guys, The Ultimate Solution in a Doomsday cage match. So
Do you know who Zed Gangster is, Simon?
I don't know.
It's Zeus, Tiny Lister.
No. So yeah, that you're getting a wide spectrum of wrestling that's like on show, beyond the fact that even within the WWE, you've got your high flyer versus your technical wrestler. There's such a wide commercially available smorgasbord of what you can have. I could see why people who like the zaniness of the Doomsday Cage match wouldn't like this, and vice versa.
But to be fair, I think a lot of people who consider themselves smart wrestling fans and rate matches on five-star scales and probably have lots of Bret Hart matches and Shawn Michaels matches that they love, for some reason, they just don't jibe with this one. And I think it is just moments like, because it's 60 minutes, there are just moments where it looks like it's reaching crescendo, and then just Bret applies a camel clutch, or they, you know, it just has to, and it just has to do that. But I also wonder if one of the issues a lot of people have is that, why did you book this as an Iron Man match and then have it be nil nil? What's the American? They don't say nil nil in America. What's the term for that? Your sports don't really deal with nil nils, do
Nah, but
Drawing is not an American concept.
I get what you're saying though. But you know, so the weird thing is that all that the 0-0 falls kind of always worked for me, and the reason that it did is because and you know, this is kind of how I saw it as a kid. Like when I watched this as a kid, I'm sitting in front of the t glued to the TV, and I'm thinking, oh man, these guys are so good, they can't beat each other. You know what I mean? Like, oh my God, like, no, they can't even, it's still 0-0. And they've been, you know what I mean? And then when I got older, seeing it from a booking perspective, like, it just kind of makes sense to me. If these are the two best guys in the company, maybe it shouldn't be 5-6. You know, maybe it should be really hard for them to beat each other, and it should be 0-0. You know, that's kind of how I looked at it as a kid, and just how I chose to look at it, you know, as a grown up.
What about you, Simon? Where would you like? Would you have rather this had ended up like, if not 5-4, maybe like 2-1 or 1-1 or something along those lines? Do you think that would? Do you think like? I will admit, when it was getting to that final 5 minute, like Sean's last flurry, I think it would have meant more if it was like 1-0 Brett or 2-1 Brett. And then at like the 58 minute 30 mark, maybe he gets the pin off the moonsault. And then for those last 90 seconds, then it's suddenly Bret Hart that's got to, because Bret Hart's
Scramble.
in trouble, and try and save himself. And then
Right.
at the 30 second mark, when he applies the sharpshooter, then it turns back. I just think if there was a fall for Sean in that moment that equaled it up, and then Brett suddenly turns it back around again, I think that would have been more satisfying for me personally as a narrative, because there are a couple of those moments, like when Brett backdrops him up to the outside, it feels like that's a perfect way of doing just a count out finish. Because I think
Right.
maybe another reason is people think maybe the reason it's nil nil is because of the politics, because they attach so much politics to these two guys that neither guy would accept taking a loss, you know? Do you know what I mean? It's like Sean would be like, why am I in my big crowning moment, am I losing the first four, which essentially
Yeah.
means if this was a regular match, I'd lose it. And Brett It's like, well, I just don't want to lose to him.
Yeah.
I want to be kept strong, and the nil nil and the overtime fits that narrative more. But again, that's people kind of putting their own extra theories of what's the story behind the match, but into it as well.
I'd say for this match, I think Novelist is right. I think nil nil suits this match because of how superpowered they are. Obviously, we've used this. We refer to the strap line when we had a chat with John Lister, the irresistible force versus the immovable objects. It's kind of a similar vibe that they're putting out there with this. However, if I go to my general answer, I do prefer Iron Man matches that have falls in, because it changes the match significantly, and it's a
It
great
does.
like bookmark, and it's how people scramble to get up for it.
It makes
Obviously,
more clear the chapter break, I
yeah.
suppose. Yeah.
And like the tactic, you can use the underhanded tactics. Obviously, like long-time listeners will know, one of the sleeper hits we've alluded to that we've done for Match of the Week is the Sheamus Daniel Bryan 2 out of 3 falls match, and how Daniel Bryan gives up a fall basically when there is a finite number of falls in that match. It's not like Iron Man, but it's how that tactically benefits him, and he nearly gets away with it.
Because I do wonder about those different versions of this match, like the match that does have some falls in it, or just the 25-minute one-on-one match that people would have assumed they were going to give us, and that maybe would have also fit more. That would have maybe been more of a Shawn Michaels match, and would have been maybe more all-round beloved rather than being one that some people have to fight the corner for. Or maybe it could have been that they book it as a 2 out of 3 falls match, or Brett just explicitly says, Sean's quick, Sean's resilient, I'm gonna test his limits. And that's what
Yeah.
he says. So they don't say it's gonna go 60 minutes, but Brett's like, I'm gonna take him into the deeper waters. So you can get why it's started off kind of slowly, but there's always that thing of it could end at any moment because you don't have the 60 minute time limit. But then it does go to just a standard 60-minute time limit that all these title matches would have been. It's just they've never come close to that in the WWF's recent history. You know, it's not your Bruno Sammartino, Pedro Morales 73-minute curfew draws that they had. They genuinely had that match in like the
Yeah,
seventh. We're
right.
not going to do that for Match of the Week anytime soon. Did you get those criticisms of it? Do you wonder what the 25-minute version of this could have been, just the one fall, and maybe, like you say, like these moves that are spread out are more tightly packed together, and it's maybe a more, not better match, but more easily digestible for the general fan. I don't know.
Definitely. I think even if you just watch the last 30 minutes of this match, you know, it's a much, you can get, you almost can cut it in half, and it would still work as its own match, and probably a better match, you know, to most people. I also wonder, do you ever think would people have maybe felt different about it if they didn't have the counter in the bottom corner?
Yeah.
Ooh.
I'm surprised that WWF are usually so good at graphics and everything. You'd think they would do like logos for them, but we just get
Oh, it's
BH
the
and
most
SM.
generic. It's the
Yeah.
most generic. It looks like a shot clock in a basketball
Yeah.
game
Oh,
in the
yeah.
bottom right-hand corner.
Now, I wondered if that was conscious to make it seem like more of a sporting endeavor.
But I would have thought,
You
even at
know,
that point, I would have thought like
that
the
makes
Chicago
sense to
Bulls
me.
logos and everything would be on those
Yeah.
score things by 1996, anyway. It does seem like very like mid-80s
It
that the
does.
way that they do it, you know.
No, I do think it kind of adds a sporting element to it now that you know. And then, you know, why looking back on just this whole, like I was talking about earlier, the lead up to this match and everything, it definitely seems like they were going for a sporting, you know, a sporting contest. So it makes sense.
There are some other little extra things I noticed. The mat has a really echoing thud. I've never heard the mat like that kind of rinking
It
sound.
does have a weird sound to it.
And it's also one of the rare instances of the WWE actually having like a logo on their ring mat. They
Right.
never have that. It's usually really basic until they did like their Mountain Dew match
Oh,
very
that's
recently.
true.
Oh,
You
my God.
know,
How has that ended up in this conversation?
maybe
And also that ring mat is filthy. I don't know who hadn't swept it or whatever. I think maybe from the Goldust Roddy Piper match earlier on or something, but that should have been given a quick clean up before the match started. Also, another thing I wanted to say, I really thought Jerry Lawler was exceptionally good in commentary for this
He
match.
was, and Vince was bad, and I think he kind of was. It almost seems like he was aware that Vince, because you know, in this match, Vince is almost doing what JR does in AEW sometimes, where he like literally is complaining about the match while you know what I mean? It almost seemed like Vince was kind of doing that like during the match, like maybe he didn't like the no fall. Like he literally, I don't know exactly, but there are some points where he even where he alludes to. Like, oh man, why are there no falls? Like, you know what I'm saying? Well, he almost like flat out comes out and says that.
That's Vince's version of a bowling shoe ugly.
It's
Yeah.
It's always weird
Pet
hearing it.
petulant Vince is funny to watch whenever he gets petulant.
Oh, I remember it was the 95 Royal Rumble. At one point, because Jerry Lawler's like changing who he thinks is going to win. And then he says two people are going to win. And Vince says, two people can't win the Royal Rumble. And Jerry literally goes, they did last year. You just hear Vince go, but that's not going to happen this time. I guarantee you that. Like, already regretting it. But yeah, hearing a pre-Puppies Jerry Lawler, because he's a guy that has wrestled lots of 60-minute matches, so he understands the psychology and obviously knows that you can't do shticky comedy stuff at this point. And also because it's babyface versus babyface, he doesn't have to do his rooting for the heel thing, which Jesse Ventura was also really good at doing when he. It's also a funny coincidence that it's been like a 6 year, the last babyface versus babyface main event, WrestleMania 6, Hogan Warrior, and now 12. Bret Shawn, depending on how you want to look at it, A-Team Rock Hogan, depending on how you want to look at it. One of those funny little I'm sure unintentional, but one of those funny little patterns, like every 10 WrestleManias, there's some it's messed up world title scene, and we might need more than one match to sort this out. Oh yeah, that was my main note as well. Also, I think you'll agree with me on this novelist. This is as close as we get to an Okada Tanahashi match, where the older veteran is trying to outthink the more physically naturally gifted younger wrestler. Did those moments come into your mind whilst when watching this match again, or?
Yeah, definitely. And as I said, you know, a few moments ago, that's one of my favorite things in wrestling is the old guy trying to, you know, show that they still have it and have to work a little extra hard to outsmart and outlast the younger wrestler. And I think this is definitely one of those matches.
I don't have any more matches about the notes about the match itself, other than just it's fun seeing them bust out moves they don't usually do. Actually, one thing I will say as well, in this time when we moan about dives and everything, the two dives that they do in this match, again, it's like, study this, guys, because how Brett works it, that he's just walking around the ring to give himself a bit of time because Sean's on the offensive, and Sean just spots that moment to climb the ropes when Brett isn't looking, and Brett not seeing it until it's right there. It's not just, I know I always have a go in, but just, I remember one of the War Games, Adam Cole's just lightly tapping some bloke on the back for like 30 seconds whilst everyone else is just looking up, waiting for that dive to happen.
Hey, turn around. Yeah, I can't say that. But as you said, that's my absolute favorite thing about this match is the moves, man. They just, I mean, Brett busts out of belly to belly, obviously a power driver. Brett's always, I'm a sucker for bridging suplexes. I love German suplexes. I love dragon suplexes, tiger suplexes, all that. I've always loved Brett's German. He doesn't do it very often, but his makes so much sense because he always does it when somebody, when they're close to the ropes, where he's getting behind them and they're always trying to grab onto the ropes, and it's the only move that he can do in that situation is bridging behind him. You know what I mean? So I've always loved his German suplex spot. I mean, Sean does like a perfect plex in this match.
Yeah.
And he does like a gut wrench sit out power bomb in this match.
Yeah.
It, like the moves that these two got, like I really think, and I said earlier, Brett's the GOAT to me, but I think this is the best Sean has ever looked in the ring in this match. Like he does, he does a power slam. He does like this shoulder breaker. He does, I think this is the best moonsault he's ever done that he does in this match. I really do think this is one of the best that Sean has looked in the ring.
Yeah, it definitely shows Sean that he didn't even do that Kijimuto reinvention when he came back. Well, he didn't do as many high-flying spots. He didn't go into those mat wrestling moves that he showed at least at some point he was able to do in those opening passages, or, you know, more power moves. It was more just sort of slowing down and making the big moves count, I suppose. And
he's more floaty than crashy, I would say.
I always thought that about his return too, is I always like, how come he didn't go to some of those moves he was doing in that Iron Man match, you know? He didn't really change his style. He just kind of, like you said, he just kind of slowed down.
Yeah, and when he did bust out submission moves, they often did not look very good. Like, he never knew how to do the sharpshooter. When he does the sharpshooter at the Survivor Series in 97, Brett has to explain that he's got the legs all the way around. And when he did his weird, like, sharpshooter figure four move that he tried to invent, it's like, he didn't seem to know what he was doing every time he put it on either. You know, he was like, I really should have a submission move at this point. Well, I can't do any of these ones. But, yeah, like you say, he surprises you in this match. And, like, and I think it's interesting because Sean himself has said, I think one of the reasons some people don't like this match is because I'm in it. That if he had the exact match...
Such a Sean thing to say.
But he's saying if he had this exact match, Brett had this exact match with someone that you expect this more from, if it had been like Owen or Davey Boy, maybe not Davey Boy, but like Owen or another sort of, or maybe the 1-2-3 kid, if they'd built up from their match 2 years earlier and this was like him reaching his pinnacle of
Mr. Perfect.
Yeah, Mr. Perfect, yeah. I tell you what, another thing I was just going to say, like, I remember, do you remember I was saying how much I loved the spot in the second Volta versus Dragunov NXT match where Dragunov just busts out a superplex in like a couple of seconds?
Yeah.
Just hits it right, and it's just like, it works so much in the, like, not needing to, let's everyone get their balance right and not do anything for ages.
Yeah.
With this one, it's Brett taking one of Sean's over the top selling moves and turning something into it, where he does the whipping into the corner and Sean does his version of the flare flop where he does it and just like sits up. So Brett just sprint, like jumps up to the second rope and hits a back suplex off of it, because that's the exact same position to do that move. I just thought that was such a clever moment, because I know there's another moment earlier in the match where Sean does his skin the cat spot, and Brett said he hates that spot because he's just standing around like an idiot, and he couldn't think of a way to make it work really in this match either. I don't remember loving this match the first two times, the previous times I've watched it, but I can say now, like, this is another one of my Brett matches that I love. Like this, I don't know, I don't even know if it'd be top 10, but it would definitely be higher than I ever would have put it before this time, because it's not like comfort eating, you know. If I'm gonna just plug in a match from the past, I would put in like a 20 minute match, a 10 minute match.
Yeah, you're not gonna, you know, turn on an Iron Man match, right?
Yeah, relates to, unless we can make a podcast out of it. If we can't make a podcast, what are we even doing here, Simon?
Exactly.
But so, do you have any more observations about the match itself? Any other spots that you remember in particular?
I also just wanted to point out, I love there is a spot where Sean takes a dive and it looks like he just kills the cameraman. I don't know what happens, but the camera just
Oh,
goes
yeah.
crazy. And I also love that spot too.
Yeah.
Again, it just the wrestling in this match is really good, you know, and just like we said earlier, a condensed version of this match with the spots moved around a little closer together. I think you would have a match that wasn't so divisive amongst fans.
As we say, we don't like rating matches, but I'm assuming. I mean, do you even bother rating matches, particularly novels? You mentioned cage match, so do you have an account there where you.
Yeah, I do have a cage match account. I rate matches on there. To me, I would give this match 5 stars just off of what it meant to me as a you know, growing up and how I see it now as a really just this influential piece of, you know what I mean, wrestling that I know a lot of people take from and have used to study how to do a match this long. And since it and through its existence, we've seen better versions of it, right? Like the Bryan Danielson versus MJF match was fantastic at Revolution last year. And
Oh.
you can see elements of this match in that match, you know what I mean? So
Simon, where would you go on this?
Kind of in the four region. Like I respect what it did. It achieved its goal. It kept the crowd hooked. It made Brett look like strong in defeat and Shawn look strong in victory. Like all of the markers were ticked. But as Novelist says, I personally feel I have seen better versions of this. Cards on the table. I was really emotionally invested in the Sasha Banks Bayley story in NXT at the time, so I am coming from a biased position. But that meant more to me, I think, than this match did to myself. Obviously, that's more an era thing, I think, than as well. But yeah, I think this is kind of akin to the Razor Ramon Shawn Michaels ladder match. It set the bar high, but it has been exceeded since.
Right. So yeah, it's been
Yeah,
passed.
I can see where you. Yeah, that makes sense.
So what if this match happened in front of a Japanese crowd in 1996? I don't know which one would be better, All Japan or New Japan, but I think obviously All Japan had better crowds, especially in the 90s. But just, you know what I mean? Like, what if the same exact match took place in an All Japan ring in 1996?
I think if the crowd was as emotionally invested in these two guys like they were for the Four Pillars of Heaven's guys, then yeah, maybe it would be right up there. But to be
Right.
fair, although the All Japan matches around this time were starting to go like 4 to 2 minutes,
Yeah.
the ones that went
Still
60,
long, yeah.
the ones that went 60, I don't think they're often cited as their best matches, except for mate. I think there's a Kawada Kobashi one that Meltzer gave 5 stars to, but I don't know if we saw it all in its entirety, to be fair. I think you're right. Like it kind of half of it's All Japan friendly, half it's maybe more New Japan Inoki friendly because it is more like sport focused. Whereas I don't know, it's a very interesting point. Like if it was essentially Misawa and Kobashi doing this match
Right.
in an All Japan ring, how would Meltzer, because Meltzer gave this, I think Meltzer gave this 4 stars. I think he said that like the first 40 minutes are 3 stars and the last 20 are 5 stars, but it's more like, you know, matches are supposed to build to a crescendo, so maybe
Right.
that's what you're actually thinking. For me, my initial mark was 4.5 to 4.75. I think I would lean much more towards the 4.75 sized of it though than 4.5.
Okay.
That'd be kind because, like I said, because it's like I do see the flaws, I do see the criticism, but I do wish we either had the 30-minute version of this match or the 2-1 version of this match or one that goes to a 60-minute time limit draw rather than it being an Iron Man match. I think each of those might have been what would have made it the 5 stars for me.
That's really interesting too, having it just be a 60-minute, you know what I mean, draw instead of labeling it an Iron Man match. I think that would have also made a huge difference in how it was perceived by people.
I've got a question for you both.
Okay.
The original plan obviously was to have a rematch of this at the next WrestleMania. What do you think that would have looked like?
Apparently, the idea that Brett had was that he would break Shawn's foot with a gimmicked boot and everything. I think it would have been somewhere towards the Survivor Series match they had that was just basically a brawl. Almost the entire match is a brawl. It'd be somewhere between the two ends of that. It's like almost a that missing middle chapter of what should have been this trilogy of matches that we really never got.
I definitely think if we would have got the rematch, it should have been a ladder match. I
Mm.
think just like the history of, Bret and Shawn having a ladder match at a house show, and then Shawn kind of being the one that went on to be the guy
Yeah.
who had the legendary ladder matches, and then Bret kind of being the one who showed it to them, you know what I mean? So I think that would have been a perfect. And then, like, you probably have to do a stip too, just off of the last one being like that, so.
Yeah, that's interesting, because if this is Shawn wrestling a Bret match, maybe that would have had to have been, even though Bret did bring up the gimmick, maybe by then what the ladder match had been defined as, that would have had to have been Bret working in a Shawn match. That would have been another
Right.
good comparison point. I mean, the ladder match I wish we'd had around this time was if, he beats Bret at WrestleMania, he sends Diesel packing at the next month in the No Holds Barred match, and then the month after that, instead of him wrestling Davey Boy, I would have had him wrestle Razor Ramon, who was on that card, I think. Or no, he wrestled anyway around that. He was wrestling at that around that time in the rubber match, a ladder match, but that'd be for the world title. That's one of those great missing matches that I wish. I mean, I don't even know if they ever suggested that as an idea, because Razor was kind of persona non grata by that point anyway. But that would, what a way to have sent both of them packing one after the other. It would have been amazing to have done it
Yeah, it
that
would have
way.
been great.
Because I mentioned one dive, I also love, because Bret does sometimes bust out that tope. And again, the
Yeah.
way he did it with this one was Shawn didn't see it coming, and then he just, like, again, it's like Bret thinking, ah, there's a moment here I can do so, and he wouldn't expect, like, he surprises Shawn with the high flying move, like how Shawn surprises him with the mat wrestling. Are there any other spots within the match we haven't covered, Novelist? Because, like you say, I mean, this episode's already gone long because you can just talk about this match for
Right.
ages. You could talk about this match for longer than an hour.
I definitely could. But yeah, just there's so many there. I love this match, man. Sean hits a really good drop kick too, and it's kind of, he's like on his knees and he just hops up and just hits a drop kick, almost not to the, obviously not to the level of Okada, because Okada's got the greatest drop kick ever, but it's similar to the way that it just comes out of nowhere right at the end of the match when they're both super tired. Like, there's some moments like that, man, where these guys have been wrestling for, almost an hour, and they're still able to pull out big athletic moves and stuff.
Oh yeah, the fitness that both these guys had. I remember this was also in the magazines. They did something that they never did. They said like how old both these guys were. Oh, they said that Shawn was 30 and Bret was 38. And like to me, that was like, oh my God, I can't believe 38-year-olds can still run
Yeah.
at that point. But like you say, just the level of fitness that these guys had, and Shawn's busting out brilliant moonsaults after wrestling a 55-minute match. And you know what? I've never watched all of the John Cena 50-minute match. Have either of you guys ever watched that?
I have not seen it.
No, I've not. That was in London, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah. And that was just done because like Randy Orton screwed up again, hadn't he? So they had to like. We'll have to do that for another one, because that's the interesting thing. Like, I would assume that Shawn Michaels led that match. So, how does a Shawn Michaels-led 50-minute match, especially with someone like John Cena? Oh God, because he did an Iron Man match, didn't he? He did that one with Randy Orton that was like a literally like a summer blockbuster with explosions and everything.
Yeah, that was like a hot. That was a 6-5er. That was a hot mess, I remember at the time. Powerslam slated it, I know that much.
It must have been like, if we do 6-5, maybe we could do 1-minute intervals as well. That could. No, we're not going to go that far. Just have Randy try to blow him up. That should kill some time. Okay, all right. This is one of those also, one of those key moments, because WWF was just scrambling for who do we make the guy in over these years. They tried with Luger in 93, they tried with Bret and again in 94, they go with Diesel in 95, and now they're going with Shawn in 96. And again, I think maybe it's so funny seeing this, because that, like, you were saying, like, I think you were reading the book, and like Shawn Michaels was clearly like, this is my moment. And I think I maybe in that moment he felt like this match hadn't been what he needed it to be, and it hadn't been booked to make Shawn look so super definitive champ. Like, if you're a Bret fan, you can feel like Shawn isn't the true top guy. He's just
Right,
fluked
exactly.
it. And like you were saying, he kind of is having a little bit of a, he's having a celebration, but he's also having the first of many hissy fits that would define
Meltdowns.
Shawn's run. Did
Exactly.
you say inside? Because before we recorded, you were just reading through the book. What is he does after the match?
So to quote it like perfectly, Brett goes, "The crowd exploded as Shawn music's played. I couldn't believe my ears when I heard Shawn angrily tell him to get the fuck out of the ring. This is my moment. I dropped out to the floor and left him there on his knees, crying with a belt on his arms." I love the fact that Brett's like, oh, he's crying. Like, all right, Brett, we get it. You're a man. Come on.
And to be fair, it's not just Brett, because I didn't notice watching this one that Jose Lothario also gets in the ring, and clearly he tells Earl, who then tells Jose, maybe not in those words, to leave to give Shawn. And he is right, but it is already like the first sign of Shawn not fully getting his way. Because, like, do you notice it when he tells Earl to, like, wrap the belt around him?
Yeah.
And it takes too long, so Shawn just pushes him off. The lovable baby face Shawn Michaels, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh.
And like I said, I think for a lot of people, the image from WrestleMania 10 that's always in the montages is Shawn doing the splash off the ladder. WrestleMania 17 is Edge doing the spear off the ladder. With this one, it's Shawn doing the zip wire down. And I think, you know, because this time they didn't have the lights and everything, but I think of the great entrances, that shot of him going down, not even in a stadium, it still looks absolutely amazing, that one particular shot where Shawn's just winding down. Like, where would you guys... I'm assuming, Simon, if you didn't know anything else about this match, you'd seen that.
Yeah. I'd seen that, and I've obviously seen him crying, doing his pose at the end. They're, for me,
yeah,
the two images that are most used out of this match, which is weird, because neither of them are of the match itself.
How do you rate that as an entrance novelist? What do you stand on, like, wrestling entrances? What types do you like more than others?
Oh, I love the pageantry part of wrestling, man, and the entrances are super important, and they tell part of the story too. You know, here, just like the extravagant Shawn entrance, and then Brett just kind of coming to the ring like he always does. You know what I mean? Or when you watch like Kenny Omega, I love when he does his crazy entrances, but then I also love when he just does the entrance where he's just kind of all business, right? Like the difference between him and Ospreay last year, the Wrestle Kingdom match, he had the crazy extravagant one winged angel entrance, and then that Forbidden Door, he just kind of came out with the belt around his waist, you know what I mean? So I love entrances. I think they tell part of the story too.
Yeah. I guess you get all the anime references as well, which just all the gaming references, they fly right over my head. I don't know why Kenny's holding that massive sword, but I'm sure it means something to him. it's this 1996 is such a strange, it's like that WWF doesn't really have an identity still at this point. Like, there's clearly, with things like the Gold Dust character in general and this backlot brawl, that they're clearly trying to bring a bit more edge to it. But they're still, like, silly gimmicks. Like, they're not on the main card, but the Godwins are facing the Body Donners for the tag team titles in the free-for-all and everything. And 96 is such a fascinating year for wrestling, because it's just before, like, so it's not, like, just when Punk takes off, but it's, like, I guess it's, like, music in, like, 1975, where a lot of it's just, like, old, fat, like, dinosaur rockers and a few people around the place. And some good stuff, but not like something that catches the cultural zeitgeist, you know? What do you think of WrestleMania 12 as an event novelist? Like, have you watched the show much, or is it just you go to the Iron Man match? And what did you think of WWF in 96 when you look back on it? It wasn't a cool time to be a wrestling fan, unfortunately.
I think part of the reason this match is so underrated to me is because this WrestleMania is not good. You know what I mean? In 1996, WWF, like you said, it's just this time where their roster's not very, they're just very top heavy. You know what I mean? It's not, they don't have that strong mid card and those tag teams at this time. It's really Brett, Shawn, and a couple other guys at the top, and then that's it. And I think that's part of the reason why this match is, you know, people that still haven't seen it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
this is not a good show.
It's as close as a WrestleMania main event comes to being a hidden gem.
Yeah.
Like a hipster's choice of a wrestling match being a WrestleMania main event.
Which should be, like, impossible because it's WrestleMania. But
it's like you're saying, Simon, like, literally a week before, Bret Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage are beating eight people in a three-tiered cage, but
yep,
that's clearly an idea, because 3 months later, Hulk Hogan's dropping a leg on Randy Savage and forming the NWO, and also debuting on WrestleMania 12, at least in this gimmick, is Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Yeah, and just quickly, again, just to draw that comparison to WCW, their attendance was half what WrestleMania's was. Granted, it's not their grand stage. You know, it's not their Starcade, but yeesh, you know? Like, having that week, like literally a week apart, that comparison can't be good.
But the Monday Night War has started, but it just hasn't become... Like, if we ever write that movie, this won't be, like, a big part of it, particularly.
Yeah.
Maybe the match that's the most significant, arguably, in this card actually is the Piper Goldust match. Because that is the closest thing to, like, Attitude Era hardcore wrestling and stuff. And have you ever watched that, Simon?
I have seen bits of it. Now, I've got to ask, as someone who's seen both, I've read the book, I've seen the drama TV show, I've seen the ESPN TV show, and the opportunity to ask an American this question, I can't let slip by. How do you feel about OJ Simpson footage being used in that match, Novelist?
Even as a kid, right, that trial was such a big deal here. I had no idea what it was or what was going on, but you would just hear that name repeatedly. And it was to the point where people my age, I'm 35, right? So people my age only knew him from that. We didn't know that he played football first. We didn't know he played American football first. So that's how we knew him, right? So even seeing the footage as a kid, you know, we're like, wait, this is that thing from the news. You know what I'm saying?
But yeah.
Looking back on it, like, it's ridiculous. It's Vince McMahon, like, weird carny humor. You know what I mean? Oh, I can't believe they would do something like that.
And Vince is like, this looks oddly familiar. Do you get it? Do you get it?
Right. He's oh, my goodness.
The way I experienced it is obviously I'm like, oh, well, that's a bit inappropriate, but oh, it's a pop culture reference. And then having read the book, the drama series, and the ESPN documentary, I'm like, oh, Christ, this is grotesque. Right.
That was amazing. Like, it had always seemed like such a, like, the ultimate American trashy tabloid story over here. And obviously, in the mid-90s, that was when trashy tabloid stories was just the UK's bread and butter. It's just like, that was every news story going on. Because I remember I was on holiday in a shop where the TVs were all on. And the O.J. Simpson verdict was being read out loud. And, like, we knew it was big because Americans cared, I guess, because NFL meant almost nothing here. To Brits, if you were to ask Brits who O.J. Simpson was, we would have said the guy from the Naked Gun movies. That's what I was thinking when I saw him on there. It's funny because this was, like, when celebrity trash culture and everything was at its peak, but this was, like, the least celebrity involved of all the WrestleManias. Right. I can't think of any celebs involved in this whole card, again, because it was, like you say, it was, like, it barely feels like a WrestleMania card. It doesn't feel, it's not in a big-ish arena. It's in a decent arena. It probably was the biggest crowd for WWF that year. But it's a six-match card, 22 people on the roster. You know, we've just come from WrestleMania 7, where there's, like, 14 matches on the card. It's a big spectacular. Yeah, it's in an arena instead of the stadium they wanted. But yeah.
There's only like 7 or 8 matches. I want to say there's only like 8 matches on the main card.
Yeah.
It's 6. Just a weird, it is a weird WrestleMania.
Yeah 6 on the main card, 8 total.
Yeah, okay. Do you have the card in front of you? So I just got it here. So do you want to go through what the matches were?
The pre-show, which was called Free For All, it was the tag team, match for the vacant tag team title.
That was when they did that spoof match with the
Hulk. That's the next one.
Although that wasn't actually in the arena. That was something they pre-taped, because I think they knew, even Vince knew, okay, this would die 1,000 deaths if we actually did this in front of a paying audience.
In front of people.
And like I said, the other match was the Body Donners with Sonny defeating the Godwins with Hillbilly Jim for the Tag Team Championship. Then we get to the main show, which is opens with a 6-man tag match between the British Bulldog, Owen Hart and Vader, managed by Jim Cornette, who defeat Ahmed Johnson, Jake the Snake Robert and Yokozuna. What a team. And if Yokozuna teams won, he'd have got 5 minutes in the ring with Jim Cornette. So now I've read the stipulation, I'm really gutted that Yokozuna didn't win. I would have loved to have seen that.
You know what would have made that match special, Simon?
Go on.
Trios belts.
Oh, God. 1996 WWF Trios belts would be a sight to behold. The next match, as we've alluded to, is Roddy Piper defeating Goldust in the Hollywood Backlot Brawl. Gives an official match time of 16 minutes 47, but obviously
I think it's like an hour, isn't it? Yeah. An hour and a half. It's longer than the Iron Man match, technically. And also, it's won by Roddy Piper just stripping gold dust of his suit and find out that he's wearing lingerie underneath. It's proto-evening gown match, I suppose. It just ends.
I would like to say we've come a long way, but that would be a lie. the next match is Stone Cold Steve Austin, managed by Ted DiBiase, defeating Savio Vega by technical knockout, which is a bit of a rarity.
That's just because he's just, I think he just put the $1 million dream, but he'd already like hit him with a chair or whatever. Also, the first match that he wrestled as Stone Cold Steve Austin, not the Ringmaster. So that's the big historical significance there.
We then have the shortest match of the night, which is the Ultimate Warrior defeating Hunter Hearst Helmsley, managed by Sable. I didn't know that bit. That goes 1 minute 39 seconds, as I mentioned.
If the Iron Man match gave us Petulant Shawn, maybe this is also like the birth of political mastermind Triple H. Just going, never again, never again.
And this semi-main event is Undertaker with, of course, Paul Bearer defeating Diesel by pinfall. 16 minutes, 46 seconds.
I'm wondering if I've ever watched that match. I must have.
It's not good.
Also significant around this time, like this event, Mark Merrill debuts backstage, gets into a brawl with Triple H because Triple H's valet, who we'd later name Sable, turns him down. And also the day after this is when Mankind makes his debut on Monday Night Raw. So it is that proper, like, something's got to happen, but we don't know what yet.
Right.
Yeah, I think hopefully this discussion has shown, like, the level of depth that it has and that those who are afraid of watching it because of its length and because of the divisive nature of it, I hope that, like, our passionate defense of it, even, like, Simon, you're, like, the most reticent, but you're still, like, in the 4 stars area for it.
Yep.
And so, is this a match that you've had to fight its corner with other people in the past, Novelist, or do you feel like you finally got something out that you've always wanted to say with this episode?
I definitely feel like just finally being able to talk about this match on some type of platform and just talk about how I feel about it is excellent. I've talked to some of my buddies that like pro wrestling. I've kind of talked them into revisiting it. Usually when I get people to watch it again, they always text me like, oh, no, you're right. Like, that match is really dope, you know? And so I have had the experience of, you know, getting people to kind of revisit it and go back to it or watch it if they just completely missed out on it, you know?
Right. So the question we ask everyone who is going to come onto the show is for them to book their dream WrestleMania match. But before that, Simon, we missed out one little bit in your booking.
Yes.
Let's just clarify it now because obviously everyone wants to know. You had Hogan Austin at WrestleMania 19. And we didn't say what you would do with the people that missed. Well, we said you'd just not give Vince a match, but we forgot to say, what's The Rock doing in this version of WrestleMania 19? So you've had the time to think about it.
Well, if I may look and give our listeners a peek behind the curtain, when you asked me this question, I had been drinking. So my exact response to you was, sod it, Rock versus Vince. Now,
Hollywood Rock against Vince would be fascinating in a weird way. Who the hell the crowd's meant to boo in that situation?
Depending on how far I want to pull on the stitches, we could have got a Rock Shawn match, which we never really got a proper one. But then that I'd have to find something for Jericho to do. But I'm sure I could. But the sports entertainment side of me, the guy who's more Shawn than he is Brett, I think Rock versus Vince at WrestleMania would have been fantastic in some way.
Who's the face in that match? Because this is Hollywood Rock, like the character we've all been dreaming, we've all been thinking, is he coming back? And he sort of has and hasn't. I like that it's not the exact same thing, but if he does bust out a guitar, I wouldn't be against it.
I think you can live in a world where you're sort of consciously trying to do a Hogan Rock thing, where Hollywood Rock's presenting as the heel, but you can try it, like, and he's got the ability to do it where the crowd doesn't accept that and sort of go against the story they're telling. If you could subvert it that way.
You don't just feel like pushing Goldberg forward a month and just doing Rock Goldberg.
Well, I mean, you did offer me that out, but no, I will die on this hill. We'll call that plan C. We'll call that after the Shawn Michaels plan. I'll have that as plan C.
bigger stupid decisions made whilst drunk have had to be kept for years afterwards. So, I can't have a go at you for that. But let's get to novelists. Now, you've had we did tell you about this ahead of time, but just to reiterate the rules, you can't do time travel, but if in your version of reality, Brett can wrestle against Kurt Angle at WrestleMania 21, if that's what he wanted to do, but it is 45, 46-year-old Brett. It's not like you can pluck Brett from right. WrestleMania 8 or WrestleMania 12 and have that match with Kurt Angle at WrestleMania 21. So with those rules in mind, do you have a match that you want to give us and make us all think of what could have been?
I do. So I had kind of one that I thought about doing, but I didn't actually do it. This was kind of my backup choice. I was going to do Brett versus Owen at WrestleMania 11 for the championship with Bob Backlund as a special guest referee.
Okay.
But I decided to go with, so one of my favorite matches of all time is Ricky the Dragon Steamboat versus Randy Savage at WrestleMania 3. And then WrestleMania 4, they completely dropped the ball and given us a rematch. So my dream match is Steamboat versus Savage, WrestleMania 4, main event in the main event of the tournament for the championship. And the way that I would pull this off is I would swap Savage and DiBiase's bracket placement. So I would put the way that the tournament brackets were, you put Savage in the place of DiBiase, and then you put DiBiase where Savage was in that bracket. So then Steamboat would then beat Greg Valentine and then move on to the finals where he would face Savage in a rematch of WrestleMania 3 for the championship. And then if you do that, you also kind of tease a Hogan versus Savage matchup on the other side of the bracket where Hogan and Andre ended up both getting eliminated for, I don't remember exactly what happens there, but
I think it's double DQ, I think.
Yes, it was something like that. So, but this would be mine.
Yeah, you could book it. Andre gets the DQ win because I think Hogan hits Andre with the chair first.
Yeah, of course he does. It's Hogan.
So you can have it be that then Savage has to get he has to beat Andre the Giant, and maybe Hogan can get his revenge there. But yeah, I thought some Greg Valentine fans might be after you now, though, novelist. But that is a really, really cool. Yeah, even just doing it as the quarterfinal match that it would have been if Valentine hadn't beaten Steamboat. It does seem crazy. It's right there.
I can't believe they did it. And you know what it is? It was just Vince mad that he left after he had his kid, you know what I mean? And then came back. So Vince, you know, had to punish him, I guess.
I noticed this. He turns Reigns heel and he turns Becky Lynch. Becky Lynch in particular, no one was asking Becky Lynch to turn heel. But they both dared to take time off for either I've just had leukemia and there's a plague going around, or I've had a child and I want some maternity leave. That's what makes someone a villain in the eyes of Vince McMahon.
Right. Literally. Not killing your girlfriend or...
Haven't we all wanted to do that?
Any of those things.
We can't do that after OJ references Lorcan. We just can't.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know. Just quickly, yeah. Just like you were saying, Simon, that year of just the People versus O.J. Simpson and O.J. Made in America both coming out in the same. It was like, how does something this tabloidy produce some of the best TV I've ever seen? Both of those shows are amazing. If anyone hasn't done that, I would suggest watch the first two parts of O.J. Made in America, then watch the People versus O.J., and then watch the half of that. And it's one of the best TV experiences you can have in recent years.
I'd also highly recommend the book as well. Maybe don't Google what happened to the author, but I highly recommend the book.
Oh, you don't mean the If I Did It book?
No. I mean the one written by Jeremy Toobin, who I think famously forgot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. For those who don't know, it was a Zoom meeting he did. He didn't end it and then started to do some other adult activities, and you guys can fill in the blanks.
Yeah, it's the main reason Simon insisted we do this just audio novelist.
So. I'm mad at myself because I set myself up for that.
But yeah, thank you so much for this novelist. Like I said, we're going to have you on at least to do a talking about hip-hop's influence on wrestling and wrestling's influence on hip-hop at some point in the future. And also, we need to do this for Match of the Week as well, so we need to bring more guests in, have them do their picks, so we can either do your Nakamura Tanahashi match, but I'm sure there's loads of other, you've already given us some great recommendations for that before, so actually getting your voice in on that is something we should definitely do in the future. I hope you've had a good time, but if people want to follow you now, and you know, Greg Valentine fans aside, how can they find you?
Yeah, just follow me, Instagram Novelist CSF, Twitter at The Novelist. I have a website, novelist.com. Check out all my music on Spotify. Just search up Novelist, NoveLiss. And you guys will be able to find me on all those things. And hopefully you guys check my music out. And I'm always down to talk about wrestling with people as well.
Simon, if people want to get in touch with you to explain the laws of slander to you.
Yeah. Not slander if there was ever like a video evidence, but oh, you mean that. Right, okay.
How can they do so?
People can get in touch with me on Twitter. I am Simon Cross Free. Free for the number of people that Shawn Michaels told to piss off out the ring after the match.
My name's Lorcan Mullen. That's LORCAMMULLAN, which is the A-N in Another Sweep of the Ring really was needed before that match started. That's my Twitter handle, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd. If you put that at gmail.com at the end of it, that's my email address. Get in touch with the show at lmtyspod@gmail.com. lmtyspod is also our Twitter and Facebook handles. Thank you once again for being with us. Novelist, are you doing anything like WrestleMania related, either for your podcasts, or is there any more? Is there any more music that you're about to release or anything like that that people should look out for?
I am releasing a new album in the next couple of months. Haven't really nailed it yet, release date, but it's done and everything about it is finished. But I can't really share any more details on that. But we'll definitely, me and Hero will definitely do a WrestleMania breakdown when the time comes, as we always do. I actually played a role in a martial arts film called Year of the Rat. It's not out yet, but hopefully it will be out this year. It's supposed to be out this year, so look out for that too.
Is acting and specifically like martial arts movies something you're looking to get more into?
So it's funny the way that it happened. I was originally just doing the soundtrack for the movie, and I choreograph fight scenes, and we shoot the fight scenes, and the guy who directed the movie saw one of the fight scenes I did, and he asked me to just, you know, come down, and they were going to fly me down and just have help choreograph some of the action sequences. And then the guy who was playing a character in the movie ended up getting hurt, and he couldn't choose the movie anymore, so then they just asked me if I wanted to do it, and I ended up doing it, and I enjoyed it. So you know, I've had some thoughts of maybe taking like a stunt class and getting more into it. So
yeah, I've seen some videos on your social medias playing, like not playing, but like doing sequences with like katanas, I suppose.
Yeah.
Is that what they would be and everything? So yeah, you've got like, you've obviously got the physical chops to do it, so yeah, it sounds really amazing, really exciting.
Thanks, man.
I'm just going to go tuck into a pizza. But until our next episode, where we'll be covering, oh boy, is this a different end of the spectrum as far as quality of wrestling goes. Our next match is WrestleMania 14. You can argue the starting point of another golden age of pro wrestling. And it's going to be one of the people we mentioned in this rundown, Goldust, but he's the artist formerly known as Goldust, tag teaming up with his new beau at the time, Luna, against Marvelous Mark Merrow and Sable, making her in-ring debut. And maybe you can argue a very important match. You can argue there's a through line from this match to another match we'll do later on in this series involving women, but boy, the journey it takes. But there's nothing to say at this point except thank you once again, Novelist.
Thank you guys for having me.
My name's Lorcan Mullen.
My name's Simon Cross.
Thank you for letting us all tell you something. And stick with us as we continue on through our March Mania.